Good to see all of you this morning. If you would please open your Bibles to 1 Kings chapter 16. 1 Kings chapter 16. We're studying during the period of the divided kingdom of Old Testament history. God has warned His people time and time and time and time again about their rebellion, about their participation in idolatrous worship. We know when the kingdom divided under the leadership of King Rehoboam, the foolishness of such a decision, that idolatry had already been introduced among God's people. We see that King Solomon had married 700 women, had 300 concubines, and he had erected altars of worship to all of these, and Solomon himself had become involved in idolatrous worship. In a class recently, in fact this week, was discussing this point with someone that if you had the opportunity to seek counsel from the wisest man who had ever lived versus folks that were young and foolish, would you not think that the wisdom of Solomon would be one that you would seek? Or perhaps if you could not seek Solomon's wisdom, wouldn't it seem reasonable to seek the wisdom of those old men who had been close with Solomon and sat in council with him during the 40-year period of his reign as king of Israel? But yet we have a young man, Rehoboam, who takes the throne, and he's propositioned by the people to make our burdens lighter. And he sets in council with those old men who had counseled his father Solomon, who had come to the conclusion, by the way, that the very purpose of God is to, or the very purpose of man is to fear God and keep His commandments. This is the whole of man. This is what it's all about. And yet Rehoboam, when asked to lighten the burdens of the people, those old men told him, if you'll lighten their burdens, they'll be faithful to you forever. But instead, it was his desire to counsel with the young men who said, you need to show them who's king and increase their burdens. And so he did, and the northern 10 tribes rebelled. Now, Jeroboam was one that had fled from Solomon down into Egypt. But upon learning that Solomon was dead, Jeroboam comes back from Egypt and is asked by the people of the northern 10 tribes to be their king. God had told Jeroboam that if you'll be faithful to me, then I will establish your kingdom. The idea there is I will establish your lineage as kings in Israel. But Jeroboam, rather than to be faithful to God, said unto the people, it's too much for you to go to Jerusalem in order to worship God. So he built an altar to worship a golden calf, one in Dan and one in Bethel. And he instructed the people to worship in Dan and worship in Bethel because he feared losing the loyalty of the people to King Rehoboam. The kingdom, of course, now divided. 10 of the northern tribes followed the leadership of Jeroboam. And now they're involved in calf worship. Calf worship being typical of the worship of the Egyptians. Jeroboam brought that back. But as we come down the pike of the kings, from Jeroboam to his son Nadab, we know that Nadab is killed by a king by the name of, or by a man by the name of Baasha, who desires to be king, and he attempts to establish his lineage. Well, his lineage goes to his son, and his son reigns as king, Elah, for 2 years. Elah is killed by Zimri, who desires to be king. Zimri's lengthy reign was the total of 1 week. He is killed by Omri. Omri had been appointed as commander-in-chief of the military, captain of the military. And Omri serves then as king of the northern 10 tribes for 12 years. Omri is a very wicked king. We've noted that there is not much revealed about Omri in the Scriptures, except as we come over to Micah chapter 6, verse 16, we see a little blip about Omri and his wickedness and how that he followed in the ways of Jeroboam. Yes.
Is it
Yes, Zimri killed himself. That's right. Not Omri killed him. You're right. He burned the house down over him, committed suicide. 1 Kings 16:18. Thank you. I misspoke. But Omri serves as king for 12 years. And his son, Ahab, becomes king. And it's Ahab that I want to talk with you about this morning. As we follow the kings of the northern 10 tribes, the kings of Israel. Now, I want to ask you a question about the kings of Israel. Any of them good? Any of them really have any good commendable qualities? Not a one. Now, when we're looking at the kings of the northern tribes of Nadab, the son of Jeroboam, Baasha, Elah, Zimri, and Omri, and even Ahab, who was the corresponding king in Judah who reigned for 41 years? Asa. Asa was the king in Judah. Let us note that Asa was, for the most part, a very good king. But as he came down toward the end of his days, he trusted in politics rather than in God, and there were consequences to that. And then he was smitten in his feet with a disease, and he trusted in the physicians, and consequently we see that Asa died. The next king, the son of Asa, in the southern kingdom is Jehoshaphat. Now, we're not going to talk about, I don't believe, time permitting, this morning, Jehoshaphat. But I want to continue the lineage here as we talk about King Ahab. King Ahab was a very wicked king, the son of Omri. We're going to follow the account of the kings, although you'll see that there are parallel, or is a parallel account, in the Chronicles. And when you're reading about these kings, follow these accounts. Read both accounts. Sometimes you find a little bit of detail in one that you didn't find in the other, and it gives you a more complete picture of the reign of these kings. But as we talk about Ahab, we left off Wednesday night talking about how that Ahab had married Jezebel, the daughter of Ethbaal, king of the Sidonians. Now, in our study, we noted that Sidon was a city. We often think of Tyre and Sidon as the ports on the western side of the land of Palestine. You'll note that Sidon is located in what province? The province of the Phoenicians. That's right. So when you consider the god of the Sidonians, we're thinking now of Baal. Often marriages were formed to form a political alliance. And no doubt that was part, at least, of the case here. But when Ahab married Jezebel, we need to note what he got. And what he knew he got. He got a woman that was one who would persecute those who worship God, as we'll see evidence in just a little bit. We note that she was idolatrous. She was the daughter of an idolatrous king. She was very open in her practice of the worship of Baal. And she not only countenanced it, but protected it and gave those who practiced it honors and rewards. Now, these are the comments found in the commentary by Adam Clark. It tells us that she used every means to persecute the true religion. She had was hideously cruel and put to death the prophets and priests of God. And all this she did with the most zealous perseverance and relentless cruelty. Now again, those are the words of Adam Clark. He continues, notwithstanding, Ahab had built a temple and made an altar for Baal and set up the worship of Asherah, the Sidonian Venus, 1 Kings 16:33, which we have transformed into a grove, yet so well known was the hostility of Jezebel to all that was good, that his marrying her was esteemed the highest pitch of vice and an act the most provoking to God and destructive to the prosperity of the kingdom. Now I want you to look in your Bible at 1 Kings chapter 16 and pick up the reading there at verse 30. 1 Kings chapter 16, verse 30. It says, "And Ahab the son of Omri did that which was evil in the sight of Jehovah above all that were before him. And it came to pass, as if it had been a light thing for him to walk in the sons of Jeroboam, the son of Nebat, that he took to wife Jezebel, the daughter of Ethbaal, king of the Sidonians, and went and served Baal and worshipped him. It appears in the wording of this verse that Ahab's marriage to Jezebel, of all the bad things that he did, this becomes the crowning point. As if the other was not enough, he took to wife Jezebel. And you'll note in verse 32, it tells us that he reared up an altar for Baal in the house of Baal, which he had built in Samaria. And Ahab made the Asherah, and Ahab did yet more to provoke Jehovah, the God of Israel, to anger than all the kings of Israel that were before him. That sets the stage for the next few chapters that we want to talk about as it pertains to King Ahab, a very, very wicked king. Now, between Ahab and Jezebel, you might suspect that Baal worship became the official religion of Israel. Now, just how far did Baal worship go? Did they offer the blood of a lamb or the blood of an oxen in worship to Baal? Just what were they willing to do? Yes. They offered their children in worship to Baal. Now here you have the people of God, generations down the pike, as it were, from those who came up out of the land of Egypt. Those who came up out of the land of Egypt, who had seen the miracles of God, who had seen the plagues that he brought upon Israel, brought upon Egypt, who had seen the crossing of the Red Sea. Now their descendants, who have crossed over the Jordan River into the Promised Land, and now years down the pike, here we have a king by the name of Ahab who has introduced worship among God's people to the extent that they're willing to take their little babies and offer them as a sacrifice to this idol. Do you see why God was provoked to anger? It makes you wonder, brethren, just how far we're willing to swing the pendulum as we shake our head in disgust and dismay at what these people did, and yet behave as if there is no real temptation facing us. And yet, look at what happened to them, and we wonder why. Now let me ask you, brethren, we may raise the question, do you think that those who immediately came up out of the Red Sea would have done this? Linda?
It wasn't that long before they made themselves a golden calf.
It was 3 months, as a matter of fact. 3 months that they called upon Aaron to make for them calves that they might fall down before them. Worship them as the gods that brought them up out of the land of Egypt. Now that just makes you shake your head, doesn't it? Look at what they've seen. And 3 months later, and a part of that time, recall that 40 days of that time, Moses has been up there on the mountain with God. And what's been happening to the mountain? Why aren't the people all gathered up there? All right, they don't want to go up there. They're afraid to be in the presence of God. But while Moses is up there, we'll ask Aaron to build us calves that shall go before us.
I was going to say, one of the natures of idolatry is it's a God you can see.
Yeah.
Whether it's the stars in the sky or wooden carvings or metal statue, something that you can see, and that's what they used to Egypt.
Something that's tangible. That's right. We want to be able to see it, touch it, feel it. But even as we see it, touch it, and feel it, we can't ever hear it. It won't ever go anywhere. It won't ever touch us back.
I was going to say, continuing what Randy said, no big surprise, because people that have to touch and feel and see, they're carnally minded. Their emphasis is on the physical and not the spiritual.
We're going to talk about that in the sermon tonight. Thank you for the introduction. That's right. Yep, that's right. That's right. It's a way of thinking. And we have to change the way we think. The way we think involves faith. And you can't take out of that equation trust in God, something that you can't feel and touch and see except from the perspective of evidence. You see evidence of His existence.
Numerous times in the Bible, God's people are likened to lambs, and I've never been a shepherd, but my understanding is that they'll follow whatever they're encouraged to follow. I mean, we have dogs at home that they would love to have a flock of sheep to direct, because my understanding is it's just not that hard to influence them. And you really see that. Somebody says, hey, let's worship this. Okay. I mean, it's like it takes nothing at all. And so those people who have that strong faith, they're not willing to be compromised or moved away from what they know needs to be their object of worship, which is God.
That's true. And, of course, it becomes very frustrating to those who want to do right and those who are encouraging right and striving to get God's people to do right, as we'll see in the next couple of chapters. But as we continue to study about Ahab and this segment of history, there's a little blip sometimes that we find from time to time in the scriptures that ought to strengthen our faith. Read for me, if you will, David, verse 34 of chapter 16. Whatever is occurring in verse 34, the writer tells us that Joshua spoke that. Well, let's go back and read what Joshua said. Turn back, if you will, to Joshua chapter 6. Joshua chapter 6. It's interesting to note the context of Joshua chapter 6. What's happening there, Juan? Joshua chapter 6. Important chapter in our history study. What's the main thrust of Joshua?
If I remember, this is one of the places that they're coming into Canaan, right? Like they're conquering Canaan.
That's right. That's right. This is the first city, the land of conquest, the conquering of the city of Jericho. Now, when they came through the city of Jericho and conquered it, there is a lesson involved regarding the devoted thing, but that's a side topic. That's not our point just here.
Well, the point was that God caused the walls to fall down. But they came in and utterly destroyed the city and burned it down to nothing.
All right.
There was nothing left. They took all the gold and silver and took it to the Lord's treasury. There was nothing left in the city.
Nothing left in the city. Now look at verse 26. Joshua chapter 6, verse 26 and 27. Juan, please.
26-27?
Yes.
And Joshua charged them at the time, saying, "Cursed be the man before the Lord who rises up and builds this city Jericho. He shall lay its foundation with his firstborn, and with his youngest he shall set up the gates." So the Lord was with Joshua, and his fame spread throughout all the country.
What did Joshua say?
"Cursed be the man who builds the city you to be laid with his foundation and the firstborn."
All right. All right, the man who attempts to build this city, he's cursed. When he lays the foundation, he'll lose his firstborn. When he sets the gates in place, he'll lose his second child. Now, what did we read over here in 1 Kings? Richard? Comment or question?
I was listening to David read that, and then Juan, and it appears that both of them are King James or similar versions, whereas the American Standard, many of the other versions say, with the loss of his first son.
All right.
And with his youngest son, the loss of his youngest son, will he set up the gates.
All right, that's right. So he's going to, the city's not to be rebuilt. Here's a curse. If you attempt to rebuild it, you lay the foundation, you lose your first son. When you set up the gates, you're going to lose your second son. And what we see in that little blip, verse 34, 1 Kings 16, is the fulfillment of what Joshua said. Now, the question I want you to think about is, how long before had Joshua told them that? Do the math. John, you're the mathematician in the family, one of them.
Long time.
Long time. Uh-huh. Well, let's do a little bit better.
We're in the neighborhood of 400 years.
All right, we're in the neighborhood of 400 or 500 years, aren't we?
So you've got Judges, and then you've got 40 with the first three kings, and then down another 20+.
All right. That's right. You got to back up to the time of Joshua too. So you got a little time before. You got a little time after. During the period of the divided kingdom, you've got 120 years. During the period of the united kingdom, you've got 300+ during the period of the judges. So a little on the front, a little on the back. And so what we know is we're in the neighborhood of about between four and 500 years. You think they'd ever read their history? He surely hadn't. Now, that kind of makes you wonder. Of course, here they've abandoned the worship of God. They're worshiping idols. They're not concerned about spiritual things, as it were. So why go back and read what Joshua had to say about this anyhow? But what we read is identical to what occurred when Hiel the Bethlehemite attempted to build the city of Jericho. Now, what does that assure us of? When God says something, it doesn't matter how many years pass. That's going to happen. Do you see that? It doesn't matter what man does. When God said this will be, then it will be.
Promise.
It's a promise.
Yeah, we read that that the prophets and the priests, stop teaching. We've already read that.
All right. So information is not being disseminated, is it? And so we got a problem. Now, during the time of Ahab, bad king, northern 10 tribes, we got the prophet Elijah, Elisha, and Micaiah. I may not be pronouncing his name quite right. I get that I in there. Micaiah, is that how it's pronounced?
I think Micaiah is correct.
Micaiah? Well, I've heard it pronounced the other way on the recording, so it gets confusing to me. But it's easier for me to say Micaiah. So we'll call him Micaiah. But these were the prophets during this period of time. Now, when we look at King Ahab had an enemy, Ben-Hadad of Syria. Now, where was Syria in relation to Israel? We've looked at this already on the map, and we shall look at it again, but I want to know where it is. It's north and just a little bit east of Israel. Now, the fact that Ben-Hadad is an enemy to Ahab becomes important when we study about Jehoshaphat in just a little bit. So we'll hold our thoughts on that until we get to that. But as you continue to study about Ahab, bringing us now to the 17th chapter, because of the idolatrous conditions that now exist in the northern 10 tribes, we're introduced to a man by the name of Elijah, the Tishbite, who was the sojourners, or of the sojourners of Gilead. And he said to Ahab, "As Jehovah, the God of Israel, liveth, before whom I stand, there shall not be dew nor rain these years, but according to my word." How long did it take for it to rain? 3.5 years. Now, we know that from Luke chapter 4, there at verse 25. If you want to make a footnote, you'll also read about it somewhat in James chapter 5, verse 17, as James talks about the importance of prayer and cites Elijah, the prophet, praying unto God to bring forth rain. And it rained. Now, more to say about that as we get further in this context, but we want to note that God said unto Elijah to get to the brook Cherith, that is before the Jordan, and it shall be that thou shalt drink of the brook, and I have commanded the ravens to feed thee. So he went and did according to the word of Jehovah, for he went and dwelt by the brook Cherith, that is before the Jordan. The ravens brought him bread and flesh in the morning, and bread and flesh in the evening. And he drank of the brook, and it came to pass after a while that the brook dried up, because there was no rain in the land. Well, now that just makes sense. We know a little bit about drought conditions, but we don't know anything about drought conditions where it just doesn't rain for 3.5 years, do we? No water. 3.5 years. Pardon me? And so, what happens to the brook Cherith? No more water. Well, we got a problem now with Elijah. What's he going to eat? God sends him to the widow of Zarephath. Now, she's got a problem too. You see, a drought is not just something that has affected Elijah. This drought has affected all these people. What's she got to offer?
Not much.
What's her circumstance?
She's down to her last bit of flour and oil, and she's going to make their last meal, and then they will die.
All right. That's all I got.
Starve to death.
We'll just starve to death. I've just got a little bit of flour and oil left, and we were getting ready to eat it. That's all there is. Me and my boy, and we're going
to
die.
And you're asking me to share that?
Yeah.
Yeah.
And Elijah the prophet tells her, you share that with me. But not just share that with me. You go cook the cake for me first. Now, what's Elijah assure her of? All right, the flour barrel is not going to be empty. And your oil container is never going to run dry. So she goes and she prepares the cake for Elijah the prophet.
Right there, where she does that, even though he tells her, you know, and reassures her, God taking care of her, and the condition she's in, that takes a lot of faith.
It does indeed. Yeah, for her to do that, make this for me first. You know, you might read and say, well, who do you think you are? There's the door. He'll let it hit you on the way out. Yeah.
In verse 9, the word of the Lord came to him, saying, arise and go to Zarephath, which belongs to Sidon, and see there, behold, I have commanded a widow there to provide for you. She was told.
She was told to. Yeah.
So, she was expecting.
Yeah. Yeah, we can comment on that and say a lot of folks have been told what to do and just didn't do it. But this required obedience on her part to make the preparations for Elijah the prophet. Now, in verse 14, it says, for thus saith Jehovah, the God of Israel, the jar of meal shall not waste, neither shall the cruse of oil fail until the day that Jehovah sendeth rain upon the earth. And she went and did according to the saying of Elijah. And she and he and her house did eat many days. The jar of meal wasted not, neither did the cruse of oil fail, according to the word of Jehovah, which he spake by Elijah. Now, we would like to think that everything's really great for the widow Zarephath and her house. Yes, Bruce?
We have to remember in verse 12 where Elijah also tells him that her son
died. All right. Well, Elijah is not telling her that her son will die. She's telling Elijah that I'm getting ready to build a fire and cook it all up and we'll eat and me and my son, we're going to die. But now you've introduced something here that we need to talk about. What happens to this widow? Everything is not well with her. Her son gets sick. What happens to him? He dies. Now what's Elijah's response to that?
Well, her response is she's kind of like, yeah, she's upset. What, you know, here I've helped you and now my son dies. But then Elijah carries him up to the upper room upstairs and revives him. You know, God causes him to be able to revive him.
Well, that's right. But look at verse 20. Elijah cried unto Jehovah and said, O Jehovah, my God, hast thou brought evil upon the widow with whom I sojourned by slaying her son? Is Elijah upset too? Yeah, what's going on? You know, the widow's upset. Elijah's upset. And he stretched forth himself upon the child three times and cried unto Jehovah. And what happened to the child? He revived, and he took him down to his mother, and he said, see, thy son liveth. Now look at verse 24. Look at your Bible. And the woman said to Elijah, now I know that thou art a man of God, and that the word of Jehovah is in thy mouth is truth. Now, I want you to study something for me. In this study of history and geography, we're going to see a number of miracles that occur in the history of God's people. We have already studied a number of miracles in the history of God's people that were designed specifically so that you may know, and so that all the people may know, that there is a God in Israel. Now we're going to look at that in the next chapter, in chapter 18 as well. Now there are several instances where that occurs, and I would encourage you to study and find a list of such passages where upon the heels, or either upon the heels or at the beginning of a miracle, it is expressly stated that you may know and that all the people may know who God is. Now you'll see that especially as you're looking back, but well, even especially as you're looking forward. You'll see it a number of times in the book of Ezekiel. David, we've talked about that. Yes. The miracles of Jesus. That's right. Yes, Juan?
That passage made me laugh because she's sitting on the brink of death saying, I only have this much flour, this much oil. And then, like, God provides. But then, granted, her getting her sun rays is pretty significant. But at the same time, she's like, oh, now I believe what I have. So,
yeah.
Now I'll believe. But I'm like, that's what it is. That's what it constantly is throughout all of this. Like, God does one thing and saves them, does whatever, and then they have to go down to the bottom, and then He brings them back up, and they're like, oh, now I know you're God.
Why do we do that, Juan?
We're good at that.
Yeah, we are. And you're right. We don't see it just here, but we see that multiplied times throughout Old and New Testament history. We'll cite an example in just a moment in the New Testament. Joy?
Could you prove it to me one more time, God?
Yeah, just one more time.
Yeah.
Well, you remember in John chapter 6, Jesus had fed the multitude, 5,000 men, it tells us, and scholars estimate that there may have been 10,000 in the crowd, who knows. But the text tells us that there were 5,000 men. Now that would be remarkable if you took 5 barley loaves and 2 fishes and fed 5,000 people. How much more remarkable if you factor in the women and the children and consider perhaps 10,000 people that were fed with 5 barley loaves and 2 fishes. Now those people saw that. Now it wasn't just that they saw. If you'll back up in John chapter 6, they saw their sick folks being healed too. Now a very impressive verse in the text of John chapter 6, and I'll have to look to tell you which verse it is. It's on the right-hand page, the left-hand column, about a third of the way down the page, where it says, on the morrow. John chapter 6, verse 22. On the morrow, the very next day, the people find Him on the other side of the Sea of Galilee, and what is it that they want Him to do? Feed them again. Yes, we want you to feed us. And He said, you need to listen to the words that I say unto you. And they want to know, well, who are you? In verse 30, what then doest thou for a sign that we may see and believe thee? What workest thou? I tell you, brethren, every time I read that, I just get kind of aggravated to the core, because what more is it going to take? What have they seen just the day before? Now, we're not talking about other miracles that they may have been privy to, but just the day before, look at what they saw. And now they want to see another miracle. Case in point, John chapter 9. You go just a little further in the Gospel of John, where Jesus has healed a man that's born blind. And their question is, who sinned, this man or his parents, that he was born blind? And Jesus just forthrightly tells them that this man was not born blind because he or his parents sinned, but rather that you might see the glory of God. And He said to the man to go wash in the pool of Siloam and come seeing. And he went and he washed and he came seeing. And what was it that those who opposed him said? Who was it healed you? Well, this fellow said, go wash in the pool of Siloam and come see. I went and I washed and I came see. That's all I know. Now tell us again about how it was you see. And he told them again. Now, how was it that you see? And he told them again. And then yet a fourth time they ask him to explain to us how it is that you received your sight. He said, I've already told you. If I tell you again, would you become one of his disciples? Well, now you answer that rhetorical question, would they? You're too slow. No! No, they're not going to be his disciple. Doesn't matter what he shows them.
Didn't he also say that no man can do these things except God be with
him? Yes, Nicodemus said that in John 3, just prior to that. Yeah. No.
Where it said, God heareth not sinners.
Yeah, in John 9, this man says, God heareth not sinners' prayer, verse 31. So he must be of God.
Yeah.
Yeah. Joy?
The whole story gives you some insight into the psychology of man, doesn't it? He asks a question, but if he doesn't get the answer he wants, he keeps asking until he gets an answer he wants.
Oh, yeah, that'd make you a good sermon, too. Find the illustration. Yeah, yeah. Well, it would. Yeah, it's very frustrating, isn't it?
Yeah.
Very frustrating. And, of course, that expresses our not only frustration, but disappointment. When we look back at Israel, we see this three-year-plus drought that's imposed upon them and the consequences of that. But if you'll drop down in the 18th chapter, we're introduced now to a man by the name of Obadiah. Now, I don't think that this is the same Obadiah. We've got a different time frame involved here as the writer of the book Obadiah. He came along somewhat later. But as we look at this text, this man named Obadiah, he's kind of a friend of Ahab, as it were. And it tells us in verse 4, for it was so when Jezebel cut off the prophets of Jehovah that Obadiah took 100 prophets and hid them by 50 in a cave and fed them with bread and water. Now, we look at that and we say, well, Obadiah, he's one of the good guys, right? Well, you'd like to think that Obadiah is one of the good guys, but he's over here allied with Ahab. In verse 8, it says he answered him, it is I. Now, Obadiah asked the question of Elijah, is that you? And he answered and said, it is I. Go tell the Lord, behold, Elijah is here. Now, how would you like that task, Randy? What was the relationship between Ahab and Elijah? Well, they're not good friends, to say the least. No. No. Now, here's Obadiah. Elijah said, go tell the king that I'm here. Well, you know, there have been a whole lot of folks that have told the king, you're here, or you're there, or you're over yonder. And when he goes to see, you've moved, you're not there. And so what does he do to the fellows that have been the messengers? Kills the messenger. Well, now, what do you think I am, some kind of dummy? You think you're going to persuade me to go tell King Ahab that you're here? Well, I'll go tell him that you're here. And when he comes to get you, you won't be here, and what's he going to do to me? He's going to kill me. Now, Elijah assures him that I'm not going anywhere. In verse 14, it says, and now thou sayest, go tell the Lord, behold, Elijah is here, and he will slay me. And Elijah said, as Jehovah of hosts liveth, before whom I stand, I will surely show myself to him today. Today is the day. Now, Mr. Obadiah, what are you going to do about that? What did he do? He went and told Ahab. And when Ahab came and he saw the prophet of God, Elijah, what did he say to him?
Is it thou, thou troubler of Israel?
Now, wait a minute. Who is it that's presented stumbling blocks in Israel? It's not Elijah. Elijah wants them to be faithful to God. What is it that Ahab has done?
Brought in one of the worst idolaters possibly.
That's right. He's found the worst crowd of idolaters that he can find, and he's married one of them.
Elijah's the troubler of Ahab.
Yes. But he's not the troubler of Israel. If you'll notice in verse 18, he answered, I have not troubled Israel, but thou and thy father's house. Now, who would that be? Omri. That's right. thou and thy father's house, in that ye have forsaken the commandments of Jehovah, and thou hast followed the Balaam. Now therefore send and gather unto me all Israel unto Mount Carmel, and the prophets of Baal 450, and the prophets of the Asherah 400 that eat at Jezebel's table. All right, now these are the folks that you rub elbows with. You go get them. And have them meet me at Mount Carmel. Now, I have a map on the board just here. And here is where Elijah has been taken, where the ravens have provided for him during the time of the drought, Cherith. But the brook Cherith dried up. We find then that he has been taken over to the widow of Zarephath. And he's been provided for by her. And now we find that he's to meet the prophets of Baal at Mount Carmel. Now, this contest at Mount Carmel is fascinating. You've read it, I'm sure, many times, heard it preached on many times. But we want to look at it. I'm not going to skip over it because you already know it. Okay? When you look at verse 20, Ahab sent unto all the children of Israel and gathered the prophets together unto Mount Carmel. Verse 21, and Elijah came near and said unto all the people, how long go ye limping between the two sides? If Jehovah be God, follow him. But if Baal, then follow him. And the people answered him not a word. Now, is this the first time Israel's ever had this choice put before them? When do you read about that? Joshua 24. What did Joshua say?
Pretty much the same thing.
He said, choose you this day whom you will serve. Whether the gods which your fathers served that are beyond the river, or the gods of the Amorites in whose land ye dwell. But as for me and my house, we will serve the Lord. We'll serve Jehovah. Now he's calling upon them to do the same thing. You know, it's amazing to me how that this very question, and I like the wording of the American Standard Translation. I've read it in other translations. But this particular translation says, how long go ye limping between the two sides? Other translations, Randy, the American, New American Standard says,
hesitate between two opinions.
Alright. It seems people are having a whole big time here making up their mind. Where are you going to stand? Well, don't you do that? Don't we do that?
You recently said, talking about, or somebody did,
Yeah. We want to sit on the fence. There comes a time, brethren and friends, when you have to decide what you're going to do with your life. What are you going to do with your life? Notice when Joshua said, as for me and my house, we will serve Jehovah. The decision that Joshua had made impacted other people. Do we see that? As for me and my house, we will serve Jehovah. Now, if you go limping between two sides, one foot in the kingdom of God and one foot in the world, like the rich young ruler tried to do in Matthew chapter 19, what's ultimately going to win? When Jesus told the rich young ruler, go sell that which thou hast and give to the poor, and thou shalt have treasure in heaven, and come follow me. How did he react? He went away sorrowful. Why? He was very rich. Now, I'll just tell you, you try to straddle the fence, not gonna happen. I wish I could remember precisely an illustration that illustrates heaven and hell. I'm going to try to take a stab at it. Some of you, John, I think it might have been you that told the story of those on the right side of the fence, and those on the left side of the fence, and those that sat on the fence. And those who were on the right side of the fence, they were told, come on, let's go to heaven. And those on the left side of the fence, they were told, come on, you're going to hell. And those of you who are sitting on the fence, you come with us, you're going to hell too. And somebody said to the devil, well, what about them? You know, they've got part of their efforts are over here in the kingdom of God. Why do you grab them off the fence and say, come on, let's go to hell? And he said, I own the fence. Now, you just take that, as my dad used to say, and put that in your pipe and smoke it. Now, that's where that is, isn't it? He owns the fence. Now, if you want to sit on the fence, where are you going? Joey?
It also calls to my mind a couple other passages where Jesus said, you know, he who is not for me is against me. And it also reminds me of Jesus saying, a house divided against itself cannot stand.
That's right.
Those are similar principles.
That's right.
You must make up your mind and be definitive about it and be on one side or the other.
That's right. And we don't want to do that. And I'll just tell you why. The evidence is overwhelming. Why is it that we make decisions that we do? You know, I'm getting off topic, I know here, but I got a call this past week from a friend of mine who preaches in Kentucky, and he was very upset. They were having a gospel meeting, and it kind of called things to mind about preparation for our gospel meeting. And he said, you know, I've been preaching about this meeting for quite some time, and he said, now it's approaching, and this was the first night now of the meeting. It was on a Monday night. He called me Tuesday morning, and he said, we have about 60 that normally attend here on Sunday morning. And he said, you know how many we had tonight? He said, 28 of our normal attendees of Sunday morning were gone. You think he had reason to be upset? Discouraged? Depressed? You know, he's trying to be lathered up and excited about something that's coming up here. And now here's the first weeknight of the thing. And over half of the people that they have were gone. Now, why is that so?
Well, you know that you and I say from time to time at the evening attendance, where were the 30?
Yeah. Over half. Where'd everybody go? My wife fusses at me, and she says, well, we're all here. Yeah, well, I understand that. And that's right, well, and good, and to be commended. But you see, the area of improvement is the very thing that we're talking about here in this text. How long go ye limping between the two? If Jehovah be God, what was it that Elijah said? Serve Him. That doesn't mean just acknowledge He's God. If He's God, follow Him. Serve Him. Now, if Baal be God, then you serve Him.
And isn't that the same as the church of Laodicea? I mean,
yep.
The one or the other, because He'll spit you out of His mouth.
That's right. Yeah, He owns the fence, don't He?